The Shared Desk, Episode 13. Hold on to something. No, you're not seeing things. This is The Shared Desk, Episode 13. Lucky 13 because of what we're talking about. I'm T. Morris.
And I'm Philippa Ballantyne.
And we have a special guest, a returning guest, a friend of the show, a friend of ours, a friend of our careers. guest, sign in.
Hey, I am Lori McLean. I'm a literary agent with Larson Pomada Literary Agents in San Francisco. How are y'all doing tonight?
And we are, yes.
We're doing good.
Through the magic of MacGyver, we have rigged up a...
We have duct taped the phone to a microphone.
and we're recording. Because Lori, unfortunately, where she lives, Skype is not her friend. So we're just going to go ahead and do it old school. We got the speakerphone set up, cranked up to high, and we're recording this thing with a really sensitive mic. Okay, so why are we here? We're not doing Crazy Uncle Charlie. We're not doing Riders Off the Clock. We're not doing any segments. And you want to know how serious we are? No drop-ins. We're not even doing drop-ins. What we are talking about tonight is Amazon.
Yay!
Amazon. WTF, Amazon? I mean, good gravy. All right, so let's get a backstory here, and then we're going to start bringing in Lori, she of infinite knowledge. So last week, Sean Ann McGuire had a minor meltdown. Don't worry, you can follow the link in the show notes. Had a minor meltdown on her live journal about the fact that due to something or other that she had no control over,
Amazon was shipping her book Discount Armageddon like a week. No, in fact, they shipped it last week, so end of February they started, and it was not due until March 6th.
Right, and we were trying to figure out what was running through her mind, because it did sound like a bit of a meltdown. Of epic proportions, and maybe she was overreacting a little bit until now. Before yes, we are name dropping here, but let's first say The Shared Desk is not in any way, we are not voicing the opinions of the authors mentioned in this particular podcast. This is me, Pip, and Lori, and we're talking off the cuff about Amazon. Mm-hmm. So right after Sean Ann had her meltdown, it was like a day or two later, Gail Carriger, New York Times bestseller Gail Carriger.
She didn't have a meltdown. But she did point out that Amazon had done the same thing to her and sent her book off early, and she was a little concerned about
She was a bit miffed.
Yes.
She was a bit miffed, to say the least. Now, so it seems like that this is nothing new, because, Pip, you read a story about how somebody was doing, about how Amazon was doing this in 2010.
Yeah.
But the author at the time...
Yeah, the author whose name just... Barb Henley.
Oh, yeah.
Henley, I think?
Yeah.
She was saying that, yeah, it happens. Yeah, I can't do anything about it. But I've already got the New York Times tag, so it doesn't bother me.
Right. But for Sean Ann and for Gail, it does bother them. And they were talking... They were both referencing this thing called First Week. And from what it sounds like, First Week is one of those things where... When the book comes out, it's a bit like in the entertainment industry when a brand new television show hits the airwaves, and if in the first episode, if you don't have the garbanzo numbers, they cancel you after episode two. Now, some shows can be argued they've been having a slow burn. I'm going to say something like for example, The New Girl, mm-hmm. because the pilot was atrocious. But when you watch it now, you notice that they kind of pulled it back. And now it's starting to get some pretty decent numbers. I mean, they're already bringing it back for a second season, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
But apparently with books, we're suffering the same thing. And I don't know, Laurie, if you know anything about this First Week phenomenon or not. But the question that we have right now is, why do you think is Amazon doing this? Why are they just flouting the? We read in Sean Ann McGuire's comments. That there were bookstores that were actually penalized by the publishers.
They used to be.
And when someone asked Gail, well, can't Amazon be held accountable for, you know, someone's got to be held accountable for this screw up and keeping you off the New York Times. And Gail actually said,
there's nothing I can do.
No. And there's no one held accountable because it's Amazon. So, Lori, why do you think Amazon's doing this sort of thing?
To sell books.
Thank you. Next question. Great. Thank you. It's been the great episode of The Shared Desk.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lori.
Sell more copies.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I said if they're going to get the book out there exclusively by mm-hmm. preempting or, you know, getting the book out there before the pub date, then they're the only place where you can buy the book, and everybody's going to rush to it. Because, you know, our society,
yeah.
we want to get to the movie premiere. We want to get to anything that we can faster, quicker, you know, than anybody else.
Yeah, I know Sean M was saying that apparently Barnes & Noble, as soon as Amazon got it out, Barnes & Noble immediately followed suit.
But
they would have to.
Yeah.
And this is where I get this is where I get confused, because bookstores once upon a time, whether it was Barnes & Noble, whether it was you know, rest in peace Borders, or you know, any independent bookstore, they would go on ahead and they would, if they were to do something like this, they would actually get penalized.
Actually, Game of Thrones and Harry Potter, I mean, bookstores gotten in deep hot water.
Amazon's like Jabba the Hutt. You know, how the hell are you going to control them? They are way too huge. So you can slap
Bush
them
to the Amazon.
Them.
Ho,
ho, ho. So much more money by breaking the rule. They don't care.
Because they're Amazon.
We have something similar in New Zealand where there's no trading on Easter Sunday or something, but we have garden centers that open up and they're like, well, you're fined $5,000. And they're like, well, we just made $100,000, so we don't care. You know, I guess it's something similar.
So really, this isn't anything political. This isn't anything in your perspective. This isn't anything other than Amazon saying, yeah, the big six, they can go on ahead and penalize us. Screw you. We're going to make money at this, whether you like it or not.
If you're an indie bookstore, you're already kind of hurting, shall we say, putting it nicely. And the last thing you want is Random House to say you're not getting the next, you know, best-selling novel until a week after everybody else right. gets it because you put it out there. You put, Seanan McGuire's book out there early.
Well, why can't the publishers do that to Amazon? They have the right to say to Amazon, no, we're going to ship it to Barnes & Noble. We're going to ship it to these indie bookstores, but we're not going to give it to you, Amazon, because you guys broke our rules. Why can't the big six do that?
They have no power over Amazon.
Wow.
Amazon's going to be the big seven.
So you're saying Amazon...
one of the big six. Can I give a little bit of historical perspective to this?
You go right away.
Okay, because, I mean, this whole... I just read over Ms. McGuire's rant, and she seems a little bit over the top. So I don't want authors listening to you thinking, oh, my God, if my book doesn't sell well in the first week, I'm done. Because I really don't believe that happens in most cases. I made a little list before you guys called me about, because I'm very conflicted about Amazon. I like some of the things they do. I detest some of the other things they do. But I feel like maybe this is, you know, in any kind of, you know, World War situation or something, I won't name names, but you probably liked one of the players before they turned really bad, showed their bad side. But the pros of Amazon is that, you know, before they came on the scene, you had to drive to a bookstore to get a book. And if the book wasn't there, then you kind of had to buy whatever the bookstore had. And these guys, for the first time, made books available on the internet, free shipping if you bought $25 worth of books. Oh, my God, you know, of course I can buy $25 worth of books. And then there they were within 2 or 3 days at your house. It was incredibly convenient. And then it was also cheaper than buying them. So little by little, they just, you know, got rid of every objection I had to buying a book in a Barnes & Noble, for example. Because at that point, you know, this is what, back in 2003 or something.
Oh, no. It's further back than that. I remember the first time I saw a T-shirt. It was a T-shirt, and this was the 1997, maybe even 1997, Renaissance Festival. It was a rehearsal, and this girl was wearing a T-shirt that had the Statue of Liberty, but the Statue of Liberty was surrounded by towers and towers of books. And I said, "What's Amazon.com?" And she, so they've been, they were around in the infancy of the internet. I still remember my first couple of orders, and I thought, Now, I will say, I was one of those purists. I still like going into a bookstore. I still enjoy that visceral experience going to a bookstore.
Can I add a little something? Being a librarian, of course, and in New Zealand, the fact that you could order things that you couldn't get
in other countries
and have them shipped was just amazing. And all of, and yeah, they did some great stuff. And people who lived in little towns that didn't have any bookstores, I mean, how else do they get books?
And I remember as an indie author, I thought it was a rite of passage for me as an indie author when I pulled up Amazon.com and I was able to type in my name and Amazon.com and boom, there was that little book Moravi, all 250,000 words of it, just sitting there waiting for you to order. I remember all that. So yeah, it was a gradual build.
And authors then looking at their Amazon sales numbers, you know, that magical number, 1 million.
Yeah.
Oh, we love watching Amazon numbers.
You know, looking at that too, some of my clients were looking at them every hour to see how their books were selling.
Those type of clients need to dial it back. They really do.
Bookstores, physical bookstores, whether it was huge chains like Barnes & Noble or indies, annihilate them through convenience and price. Mm-hmm. That's what it came down to.
Right.
And then in 2007, they actually made ebooks viable by putting the Kindle out there. There had been Rocketbook before that. There had been the Sony e-reader, but Rocketbook didn't go anywhere. And the Sony e-reader was embraced by the publishing industry insiders, but that was about it. It wasn't a phenomenon. But they had enough marketing muscle and dollars to put it behind Kindle to actually make ebooks viable.
Mm, right.
And then when they coupled that with Kindle Direct Publishing with 70% royalties, when everyone else was getting maybe 10% on average, this made ebook publishing viable and was a total game changer in the industry. And what you're seeing are the effects of that now. Amazon is making so many billions of dollars that they can say, screw you, Simon & Schuster. We're going to put that book out 3 days early, a week early, and come after us if you dare.
But now here are some of the...
We'll buy your books for a week, or we won't push them, or we won't give you ad space, or whatever it is.
But now here's some of the shenanigans that I would argue against Amazon. Now, yeah, I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly in that Amazon was a game changer. As a matter of fact, Amazon did something that was at one point impossible. If you were with a small house, they made your books easy to get. Now, they made them easy to get for readers. But I remember in the days of Moravi, in the days of Billabub Battings, in the case of the Singing Sword, when it first came out with Dragon Moon Press, I was having intimate discussions with my publisher, Gwen Gades, at the time from Dragon Moon. And she told me about how she lost money on her sales with Amazon, because Amazon would randomly knock something down, and she would tell them, I don't want this discounted. I do not want this title discounted. Please stop discounting this title. And yet Amazon said, no, we're discounting the title. And it was random, and it was never
today too.
What?
They do that today.
Yeah.
Right.
They still do.
Right. And you know, so that drove my publisher a little batty. While it might have helped sales, it was hurting her business. And I noticed that the Big Six didn't really care about that, because they were okay, you know, making the whole situation, you know, hey, you know what, we're selling enough books here through Amazon, so we're okay with that. Now fast forward a few years, and suddenly one of the Big Six got into a bit of a for lack of a better term, a pissing war with Amazon. It was Macmillan, wasn't it, Lori?
Right. Well, yeah, this was a couple years ago when the CEO of Macmillan flew over to Seattle from New York, and he told them, look, there's this thing coming out called the iPad, and Apple's going to have an iBook store, and we think it can give you a run for the money. And Apple has told us that they want us to be on the agency model, which means the publisher sets the price for the book rather than the distributor. Mm-hmm. And Apple will get 30%. That will be the discount rate. And so we want you to do that too. And Amazon said, you guys are crazy. We're not going to do that. And they bickered back and forth. And finally, they left and they said, well, let us talk about it and think about it and we'll get back to you. And the CEO said, fine. And he flew back to New York. And by the time he landed, they had taken all the buy buttons on any Macmillan books. And this includes St. Martin and Thomas Dunn and Griffin and Minotaur, and had deactivated all the buy buttons. Nobody could buy any Macmillan titles.
Ouch.
So this is how these guys work. They're very predatory. They see books as a commodity. They don't care whether you get your $25 buying a chainsaw, a toothbrush, a book. It doesn't matter to them. And so Macmillan came back and said, okay, other big publishers, what are we going to do here? And they all stuck by their guns, and Amazon eventually caved. But that was a couple years ago. Mm. That was before the Kindle really got traction. That was before ebooks became a huge market. That was before publishers right now are making most of their profits on ebooks because they have old contracts with lots of authors where they're paying them maybe 8 to 25%. That's all. So that 92 to 75% is going in the publisher's pockets. I mean, Publishers Weekly said 2 weeks ago that Simon & Schuster only made a profit last year because of ebook sales. So this is huge, and Amazon is the big dog. I mean, they're more than the 800-pound gorilla. They're like a pack of gorillas.
But didn't Once Upon a Time, I was in some sort of cough syrup stupor or something like that, but I remember
I hear that you are in that a lot.
I remember a time where I'm going to probably butcher his last name, Bezos?
Yeah.
Jeff Bezos, the guy who founded Amazon, at one time he said he wasn't out to get the brick and mortar stores. He wasn't out to take them down. He wasn't out to...
It just happened, I'm assuming, along
the way. he was basically saying, I want to work with bookstores. I'm just a different way of getting books out to the public. That was kind of the wide-eyed way he was portraying himself. He doesn't seem to be doing that now. He does not seem to be the friend of anybody other than Jeff Bezos and Amazon. I mean...
Yeah.
I think that was probably
Amazon's
always the case.
Very predatory. They are all about Amazon. I mean, come on. They encourage Kindle owners to spy in bookstores and then buy online.
Oh, I forgot about that.
This was the part that I went, wait a minute. Even as a bibliophile, even as just a consumer, I'm like,
that's not cool.
That is major uncool.
Over the top.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this, T. You know, right now you can be on Amazon and you can get 70% of the royalties.
Funny you should talk about this.
We should talk about that.
You know. I'm just going to say this. Lori.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm just going to say this, Lori. I love you as an agent, but you need to be paying closer attention to my Twitter and my blog. I just released this past week Aladdin and His Wonderfully Infernal Device. It's my first novella, and I released it for $1.99 on the Kindle. And I released it through Kindle Direct, the Kindle Direct Prime, the KDP program. Now, I've got a lot of heat. A lot of heat saying, why isn't it available for the Nook? Why isn't it available on Smashwords? I have a Kobo. Pip did a, I'm going to turn it over to Imagine That Studios office manager, Philippa Ballantyne.
Who just recently crunched the numbers.
She did a pie chart. She did a pie chart, Lori. A pie chart.
We're sitting here, I'm talking smack about Amazon, but, To be honest, they're like, looking at the pie chart, they're like 4 or 5 times, the amount of ebooks that we sell through Amazon is,
I mean, Amazon's got Amazon.
For every 10 books you sell on Amazon, we maybe sell 2, maybe 3 on Nook.
I'm surprised that you're selling that little on Amazon. They're usually like 75% of the ebook sales out there.
Yeah.
Well, now keep in mind, this is just the first week that the book's been out. I mean,
tomorrow Kindle Select, where you're just exclusively on them for 3 months, right?
Yeah, three months.
That's the plan. As a matter of fact, we just did and the reason why we did that was because we wanted to make it easy. We wanted to do a special deal. So first week it's out, boom. We did 2 days, offered it for free. You know, and I mean, So yeah, I mean, as much as cutthroat as they are, the Kindle and Amazon in general, and now granted, I'm a Nook owner because so I've basically denied myself my own short story. But yeah. but at the same time, the reason why I went with Nook was because I wanted to support Barnes and Noble. There was there was the shenanigans with, saying, hey, go into other stores, spy for us, and we'll give you a $5 discount. You know, that's, I just can't buy that, which is why I chose to get a Nook over a Kindle. And, you know, it's funny.
Can I tell you something about that?
What?
Barnes & Noble got invested in by Liberty Media and, gosh, I can't off the top of my head remember the other company that, the other investment company, basically, big dogs that came in and invested in Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. And now they're talking about spinning off the Nook and selling it to somebody else so they
Ooh.
Can concentrate on their core business.
Wow.
And Ooh. I look at it and I say, these are the same kind of guys who run Amazon, okay? So yeah. Where Barnes & Noble, you could maybe say, Len Riggio and his cadre, they love books. Well, I don't believe that anymore. I believe that they're in a business. They're trying to make money any way they can. And if they can sell off the Nook, then what is the advantage of having a Nook over a Kindle?
Thanks a lot. I appreciate that. I This is why.
However, it should be said that we have iPads, and on those iPads is the
Kindle reader.
So yeah. It's not like we've cut ourselves off from Amazon.
No, we haven't completely cut ourselves off of that. But now, but kind of stepping back a bit, here's this is going to actually be a pro question concerning Amazon and how it affects authors. The New York Times bestseller title. You know, that all-hallowed New York Times bestseller title. It has been made perfectly clear that two things about the New York Times bestseller title. One, nobody knows how it works except for the people from the New York Times.
That's right. And guard it just
right.
Holiest
they,
of holies.
They guard that thing. They guard the thing better than the Shroud of Turin, okay? Now, second thing is the New York Times have made it pretty clear. They've made it pretty clear that while they don't reveal anything in the formula, they're kind of turning a blind eye to sales on Amazon because it is easy to game the system at Amazon. But here's my question is, and you know, turn it over to Laurie, and then of course, Pip, if you want to chime in, because we've had this discussion. Does the New York Times bestseller moniker still matter in the days of successes like Amanda Hawking and like J.A. Conniff? Because, I mean, you know, Amanda Hawking in an interview, you know, before she signed on with St. Martin's, she said, yeah, I just paid cash for my house. You don't hear a lot of New York Times bestsellers talk about cash for their house. They're talking about getting a speaking gig so that they can, you know, and they're hoping that maybe DragonCon will pick up their expenses when they fly down there. You know, I mean, and here Amanda Hawking is.
Authors, they make a lot of money. Don't let that fool
really?
You. But, I mean, come on, the Amanda Hawkings, the J.A. Conrads, the... John, gosh, can't even remember his name now. It's late here.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
But anyway,
those guys.
But you know what I'm talking. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but they're all exceptions to the rule. I mean, you know where the New York Times list comes in is bookstore ordering. Is that when they see that it's on the New York Times list, they just order all the ones from the New York Times list. All those bestseller things you see in the supermarket, or you see in a bookstore, or you see in other places where. They just happen to sell books too,
like Target and Walmart and
restaurants, or you know, restaurants that have magazine and book stands in their restaurants. They order off New York Times bestsellers, so that's where that list comes into play as being important.
Mm-hmm.
But that's physical books. If ebooks truly are going to be, you know, 50% of the market a couple years down the road, and I believe they are, then does the New York Times list mean anything? I don't know, except as a curator position where someone's looking at it to say, well, if they've sold that many books, you know, our sheepish nature as human beings, oh, if all these other people bought that book, I can buy it too. I should buy it because I should know what's going on, and I'll enjoy it because all these other people read it and bought it.
Mm.
So that to me is the worth of the New York Times bestseller.
I suppose, I mean, the New York Times could adjust itself to compensate for the fact that ebooks are suddenly, you know, 50% of the market suddenly jumps to ebooks. The New York Times would have to adjust itself to you know, take that into account.
But again, but see, if the New York Times does it, then that means that the New York Times, yeah, they'd have to basically bow they would have to bow to the powers that be at Amazon. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about decades upon decades of, you know, tradition. A la the Walsh. I mean, come on, you know.
Tradition and a bag of chips, you know. What will that get you?
No, no, the New York Times is one step away from the pretentious level.
Well, I mean, is the Amazon ranking better than the ranking?
But where I was going with this was that the New York Times is one step down from the pretentious level of the Wall Street Journal. I mean, the Wall Street Journal, the print version of the Wall Street Journal, still uses woodcuts. They still use woodcuts for their photographs. I mean, you can't get more pretentious than that. But right underneath that is New York Times, and right underneath that is their hallowed bestseller list, which it seems to be the golden fleece. It's what every author dreams about. And yet, you know, I mean, I remember having a debate with an author when he was a self-published author. He was making something around the lines of some ridiculous amounts of money, somewhere between $20,000 to $40,000 a month. And he was willing to take a $200,000 hit so he could sign on with one of the big six. And I looked at him like he wanted me to tell him, don't sign the contract. Or no, he wanted me to tell him, sign the contract. Sign the contract, because, you know, you have to sign the contract because this is your ticket. And I kept telling him, don't. He had a problem with this one clause in the contract, and I said, then don't sign it. And we literally got into a shouting match over this. And I screamed at him. I was like, what are you doing right now apart from writing? And he goes, nothing. I said, how much money do you make a month? He gave me that ridiculous sum. And I looked at him, I said, so why in the name of God, if you are already writing full time, are you doing this? And he said, validation. Mm. Now, yeah.
I say ego, come on. Give me a break.
I know we're kind of getting off subject, but this is my point. Does the New York Times bestseller list matter in an age where people are making the Amanda Hawking and the J.A. Conneth? I mean, does it really matter? I mean, would Pip and I like to be New York Times bestsellers? Sure. Would I, if someone said to me, okay, T, you can be a full-time writer, but it will cost you the moniker of New York Times bestseller. You know what I would say? Where do I sign?
Yeah, but why do people buy brand name anything, you know, when generic is just as good? Ego. It's the image that they want to portray to everyone else.
Well, then, you know, then on that note, I'm just going to do a real quick promo for Archer Farms of Target. That's okay. Best stuff on the market. I'm just saying. Buy your bread, Archer Farms. Screw Wonder. Get Archer Farms. Okay.
We've just switched to generic.
So bringing it back.
Here, you know, New York Times bestseller list. Okay, it'll rise or fall based on its own merits. You know, the same books that are on the New York Times bestseller list are also on the Amazon bestseller list.
That's true.
List and any other bestseller list that you're going to come up with.
I will say this though.
25% difference.
I will say this is that, and I don't think this is too far off the base. If it is, Pip will pull me back. Verbally, it's that one of the differences between the New York Times bestseller list and other bestseller lists is that it seems like bestseller, particularly on Amazon, people throw that title around.
Oh yeah,
people really throw that title around.
A lot of writers have been following me on Twitter lately, and
that's Twitter.com.
I would say that about 85% of them have the word best selling in their profile. It drives me.
Levels, and yeah, anybody can be a bestseller because there's only five books in that category.
I know, but it drives me batty.
It's almost as if the Amazon bestseller list and the Amazon rankings, it's almost devalued.
Yeah, the whole
idea of bestseller. Because once upon a time, if you said you were a best-selling author,
everyone went New York Times.
Right.
And you guys, it's going to get even worse with Kindle Select. This program where for 3 months you go with Kindle exclusively and they give you 5 days of putting your book out for free.
Yeah, we just did it.
Something for that, you know, value. Like last month, they have $6 million as a slush fund, I guess, to pay people. But you won't get the true value of your book. Last month, it was $1.60 for every book you sold. That's what you would get, even though you were offering your book for free. So, yeah, I mean, that whole thing on Amazon, I think that's a misstep for them. They're trying new things. Mm. They've got so much money, it doesn't matter. But the New York Times is the other end of the spectrum. What I fear from Amazon is what I fear from any kind of monopoly, that history shows us what's to come. Once they destroy the competition, then all bets are off.
Yeah.
And all the nice things that, you know, the facade that they're showing is going to dissolve, and you'll see the end of 70-30 is royalties, except maybe if it's split the other way where the author gets 30 and Amazon gets 70, and on and on, step of the way.
So can I ask, do you think that is inevitable?
Yes, I do.
Wow.
Whoa! You heard it here first!
So what you're saying is that there's a possibility the Mayans could have been right. They were just talking about Amazon. They were talking about the Amazon! That's the Amazon they were talking about. They always thought it was the river. It was the actual Amazon.com.
It's the flip.
Yeah, yeah.
It's from Mars, you know.
Oh, my God.
So genetics and time travel.
So here's the big question that I'm going to throw out to the ladies.
I thought that was a big enough question.
I know. Well, yeah. I mean,
I'm still sitting down.
So we were talking about the whole, early we were talking about how the penalties that the Big Six as individuals could enforce on bookstores, and they Amazon is like, going ahead and penalize us, we don't care. So if the Big Six really are that upset, and it seems like it's less about the Big Six and more about authors, but if the Big Six are this upset about some of the shenanigans that Amazon is pulling, is there anything that they can do apart from getting on a unified front and just saying, screw you, Amazon, we're pulling our books and we're just going to sell from other venues?
Well, we have entered a period of war. I don't know whether you realize that or not. But when Barnes & Noble refused to carry any of the of Amazon's new imprints, you know, the 47 North, which is their science fiction and fantasy imprint, Montlake, their romance imprint, Thompson Mercer, their mystery and thriller imprint, and I'm sure they'll do everything under the sun, children's, YA, you name it. Anyway, when Barnes & Noble said, you know what, we're not going to carry any of your books in our store, and then Books A Million piled on and said, yeah, we aren't either, and a whole bunch of indies said, yeah, neither are we, then Amazon came back with, I guess, well, then what we're going to do is we're going to open our own brick-and-mortar store in Seattle. We're going to make it as much about authors coming here to do book signings and give presentations and things as we are about selling books. And, oh, yeah, the million other things that Amazon sells. And so to me, that was like the first
salvo.
Bow.
Okay. Grab your helmets. It's on.
Yeah, yeah.
On the distribution level.
Right now, I got
publishers to join in too. And you already hear rumblings, the digital book world in January in New York. You heard some rumblings that people were saying, you know, Amazon just wants to destroy publishing and we're not going to let it happen.
Man the barricades!
You did let it happen, New York, because you haven't done anything in 200 years. And you put the authors at the bottom of the heap, and you give them crappy royalties, and you don't give them any marketing. And, you know, it's almost like torture by Chinese drip of water on your forehead. How long are the authors going to take it before they revolt? And they're revolting to Amazon. Unfortunately, that's not such a great choice.
No.
But it's the best game in town.
Yeah.
You know,
to force the publishers then to reevaluate what they're doing and say, now Amazon's a publisher in addition to being a distributor. And remember, all of these publishers, the Big Six in New York, Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin, Random House, Simon & Schuster, all of them are owned by humongous multinational corporations.
Conglomerates, right.
Goldman, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Pearson, people like that.
Yeah. So they've got some strength behind them as well.
Companies are not just going to sit by and let Amazon eat their lunch. You know, they're all going to, like the mafia, they're all going to come around and go, we got something to talk to you about.
So we can expect a knock on the door. So is Rupert Murdoch going to turn up at that door and threaten to break our kneecaps?
Yeah, there you go.
Maybe
your
son will.
Well, it is.
He'll have all kinds. I mean, he's probably tapping Amazon. Amazon's phone.
There you go. Misrepresenting all the facts, you know. Amazon's just a fascist company.
So the question now, I have another question. If that's gonna be,
I
have a question. If that's gonna be the war, are the poor authors gonna be caught in the crossfire?
I mean, are the authors gonna be the cannon fodder?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I mean, the authors could also be the resistance movement, and they could be playing one against the other.
Vive la literature!
That's for them, and be, you know, it's wow. Like once we got WebMD, you could become an informed patient, and a lot of people are informed patients, and they really help their doctors give them good diagnoses. I look at it the same way with authors. They have to get into this business. They have to understand what industry they're in, and they've got to look at Amazon and study it. Mm-hmm. They've got to know what the big publishers are doing, even if they're independent or self-published, or with a small publisher or a regional press or a university press.
Now I will agree with you 100% on that, but I've been pounding that pulpit since 2002. You know that about me. You know that. I mean, I pulled Pip kicking and screaming into the self-promotional realm with some of her works.
I wasn't struggling that much.
You weren't struggling that much, but I remember when you came to me and you said,
"Oh, here we go."
Yeah. I made you Ballantine. I can break you.
I can also hit you with a mason jar.
But yes, you could. But the point I'm getting at is that authors have to
be informed.
They have to not only be informed, they've got to take just as an aggressive of an approach on selling their stuff, just as an aggressive approach on how their stuff is represented and also how they themselves are represented. Going back to Shauna Ann McGuire, the meltdown that she had, she really shouldn't have. I mean, I realize it's LiveJournal and people kind of use that as a convenient excuse, but quite honestly, she needed to dial that back. She could have dialed that back. Yeah. You know, she didn't have to have it at 11.
Gail only
kind of frantic and manic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
She even says at one point that she's got OCD.
Yeah, I think she's. Yeah. So. Gail was like at a two.
Yeah, Gail was at a two, but that two was a very clear, sharp, resounding two.
Yes.
And I mean,
you know what? There's no such thing as bad publicity. I mean, before this, I did public relations for 20 years for the high tech industry. I mean, Shauna McGuire went viral. People who didn't even know who she was.
That's right.
That's true.
I'm going to Amazon to buy that book.
Well, and
I'm going to stick it to the man.
Yeah. Now, but going back to since we brought up since we're talking more or less about the Amazon initiative of starting up a brick and mortar store.
Mm.
Now, I mean, I applaud Amazon to an extent that that's a pretty ballsy move to say, okay, fine, we'll do it ourselves.
And in Seattle? Wow.
Well, and in Seattle, you know, I mean, but then again, you know, I think that was also a calculated move because one, it's close to HQ. Two, it's within spitting distance of Powell's Books.
Yes.
They can take down Powell's Books.
Not Powell's Books.
Yeah, but
I haven't got there yet. You can't destroy it.
But
it's so nice.
But here's here's the other thing to consider. Remember the hoo-ha when Apple said, "Well, you know what? People aren't going to." Because I remember when Apple struck a deal with CompUSA, and CompUSA put them in the back corner of their store. You had to look really hard after CompUSA said, oh yeah, we're going to make it very clear where the Apple section is. And I watched the people in CompUSA avoid that corner of the of CompUSA. So what happens? Apple goes, screw you, we're going to make our own stores. And everyone's like, well, there's the end of Apple. And I remember when that Apple store in Tyson's Corner opened. It was the flagship store. And it was literally, the line went outside the mall and around to the other side.
Guys, think of it, because bookstores have a legacy. They have legacy systems.
Right.
They have the way they hire people, the way their books are lined up on shelves and everything else. The biggest thing they've done is add some stationery and a coffee bar.
And Wi-Fi.
Think of this from the ground up and say, how can we do it totally differently?
So the upside is, you know, Amazon could be facing the Apple Store, you know, the Apple Store success. They could also be facing the Gateway Store, because if you remember back in the day when PCs were packaged to look like cows.
Oh, yes, I remember.
Yeah. And, you know, the gateways were apparently an answer to the Apple Store.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're kind of hard pressed to find a Gateway Store now.
Really? Do they still exist?
Different customer, though. You know, Gateway was cheap-ass PCs.
Bada bing.
Apple was top of the line.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah, you're right. I mean, Amazon's kind of bottom of the line, right?
Well,
they have any big-ticket cachet?
And that's the thing. Because Amazon, when Amazon was just books, I would say that's a slam dunk for Amazon.
Yeah.
But then you're going to get people that may go to that Amazon expecting to find that hard to find Skylander or the hard to find, you know, zoom lens.
Favorite,
you know,
the chainsaw.
Exactly. Yeah. They're looking for
that's
the
more like Walmart, isn't it?
Exactly. So the question is Amazon going to make a books only store? And are they, and you got to give Barnes and Noble credit for the idea of, hey, if you've got a Nook, bring it to our store, hang out in our coffee shop.
You can read any book you want.
You can read all the books you want, and you know, and it's okay if you got your Nook. Is Amazon going to offer, are they going to follow that model? Are they going to do just books, or are they going to try to, are they going to try to compete against the Targets and the Walmarts and places like that?
I would say there's your next interview on the shared desk.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos. Yeah, that's going to happen.
No, the person in charge of the brick and mortar stores. Get him.
Yeah, there we go. That actually would be kind of fun.
We do. Yeah, we have a nice little Barnes and Noble nearby. We could do that.
We got a great relationship with them. We can talk about the Nook and all that good stuff.
Yeah, but so when any news about when the Seattle store is supposed to open or?
You know, I don't know. They were just. It was kind of like I think they kind of had it. They have a lot of things going on in the background, you know, on the QT. But as soon as Barnes and Noble were like, ha ha, we're not going to carry your books. They're like.
Yeah, really?
Back. We're going to build our own brick and mortar store.
So they kind of blurted it out like, well, we're going to build our own brick and mortar store.
Yeah.
So there.
That's exactly what it's like.
Nanny, nanny, boo, boo. I mean, I'm sorry, but to quote the late, great.
Barnes & Noble, it goes, yo mama.
Yeah. I mean, really. I mean, honestly, I'm really hoping Amazon is not doing that whole Muammar Gaddafi thing. Oh yeah? Well, hey America, here's my line of death. Cross it. I dare you. Okay? Cross this line, you die. Cross this line. This line. This line. Okay, you know what? You can knock on my door. I'm not coming out. Nanny, nanny, boo boo. Props to Robin Williams. I mean, seriously.
Okay, here you go. I love that you're calling me on the phone scene instead of Skype, because then I could do all these things without you knowing what I'm doing. So I get up online and it says online retailer Amazon could soon be making the trip to the physical world. It's planning on opening a brick and mortar store in Seattle in the next few months. And this is from a
Well, you know.
And it says it will serve as a testing ground for Amazon and maybe the first of many across the country.
Ooh.
Well, now, you know what? And I was just thinking this. Amazon has got the pick of the lot of where they could open their stores.
Where Borders,
yeah, where Borders used to be.
Availability.
We still have our.
But you know what? Here's the question I have.
You have a question.
I have a question. Could you see the scenario in which they sink too much money into bricks and mortar stores and it starts sucking business away from them, and then they have.
Well, that could happen too. I mean, it really. Because if
Barnes and Noble's bricks and mortar stores are not turning a profit, then why bother with. Why would Amazon sink money into it?
Well, you see, Amazon could be doing. Now, granted, we're all speculating here, but hey, why the
hey,
hell?
Hey, Amazon,
not?
Give us a call.
Yeah. 703-791-1701. Yeah, thank you. The idea is here is that okay, well, you know, what if Barnes and Noble could easily go, okay, you know what, Amazon? You go ahead and just, you know, take those empty border stores. We'll just sit back and watch because that's what we did with Borders. I mean, especially because Borders, part of the problem with Borders, part of the problem that led to Borders one of many, many problems, don't get me started on their customer service, was, and again, now, ooh, the ding, that just brought up something, was that Amazon could try to diversify. One of the things that killed Borders was all the crap they started bringing into their stores. They brought in less books.
DVDs when everybody was going to download.
Really?
Really smart there. Really smart there, Borders. Now, here's something else, too, because I have a question. Amazon, when it comes to customer service, it's been on the anonymous level. You never see the people behind the curtain at Amazon. We have no idea. Apart from, you know, you mail it back, boom. That's not really customer service. Now Amazon is venturing into the brick and mortar, physical, face-to-face customer service. I believe all three of us have dealt with customer service in some way, shape, or form. Do we think Amazon is ready for this jump?
I guess we'll find out. Very shortly.
Oh, come on. Come on. Show some sack there, Ballantyne. Oh,
I just think
starting in Seattle, there's going to be a lot of local love for them.
Yeah.
That's true. A lot of local love.
Good area.
But then Borders started off strong as well.
I want to see the Amazon store in New York.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah, because, you know, because it was Seattle. You got the high altitude and you got the strong coffee.
Imagine.
And everyone's just kind of mellow but high strung all the time.
I can see all the New York Big Six publishers just going and standing outside Amazon store just.
Imagine they're standing outside picketing, or they pay people to go out there going like.
I just had this image.
It's an evil place in there.
I just had this image of Diana Gill. I'm picturing our editor Diana Gill with a big old sign saying, "Hell no, we won't go, Bezo. You know, hell no, we won't Bezo."
This is the empty.
Nothing but love, Diana Gill. Nothing but love. But no, I mean, so I guess now. With all this wild speculation we've had on the show.
It's fun to wildly speculate.
Yeah, but we've got because Lori's here, we have the prestige of an agent here with us.
Prestige.
The big question that I have for you, Lori, is what can authors do? Are we as authors, are we going to be cannon fodder, or are we going to be those lucky individuals?
Do you hear the people sing? You know, it is a sound.
I mean, are we going to be? Remember, Les Mis didn't end well.
No,
folks.
Let's cut out the Les Mis.
There were a lot of corpses on that barricade, if I remember correctly. I mean, are we going to be the corpses on the barricade, or are we going to be? Are we going to be like the I can never remember the characters' names, but it's the couple that ran the house. They sing a wonderful song at the end of Les Mis called "Beggars at the Feast," where basically they have been making money off of selling the remains of the dead. I mean, where do you think authors are going to fall?
Boy, you know, things are moving so quickly that it's really difficult to have any kind of a crystal ball in front of you and know where this is going to go. I fall back on my advice earlier where I said that authors really have to get to understand this business. They have to, it's a very individual decision, you know. You've decided to go with Kindle Select. Maybe it's even just, an experiment for you with your novella. But by doing that, you're giving Amazon some power over you, and say it goes really well, and you sell a whole bunch of them, and you're making a lot of money. You're probably going to do more. You're going to do your next book there. Then maybe I come to you and say, well, hey, T, how about the two Moravi books and the two Billy books? They want them at the 47 North imprint of Amazon, and they're willing to give you a big advance. And you say, okay, Lori, I'll go do that. And then you've got your e-books there, too. And then all of a sudden, you're heavily, heavily invested in Amazon, and then they slam you and say, we're going to a 50-50 royalty scheme, or we're, like I said, we're going to a 70-30, but you're the one who's getting the 30 now instead of us. And that's what I fear, is that so many authors see, they're in it for the short term, like, oh my God, I can break in there with ebooks. Oh my God, I can do Kindle Select and get a couple $100 a month where I was getting, you know, 5 or 10. Oh my God, I can do all this other stuff. The Amazon imprints are actually buying and paying decent royalties, whereas New York is just clamping down, giving you bad advances and not taking as much. Even mid-list authors who have earned out are sometimes not getting new contracts. This is kind of unheard of, but that's what we have in New York right now. So they're kind of playing into Amazon's hands because Amazon's saying, hey, we're here.
Over here.
We're buying, man. Yeah. They're taking editors from New York and putting them in charge of their imprints, you know, acquisition editors. They are paying decent advances. They're paying higher royalties than anybody's seen. And they're getting some really good New York Times best-selling authors. So as we invest more and more in Amazon, you know, what's the price? What's the price you're going to pay?
Oh, it sounds like
that's what an author has to ask.
Selling your soul to the devil.
You can't go into this blindly. You can't go into this short term.
Right.
I've mentioned monopolies before. This is always what happens.
See, what we've been talking about here with Amazon is, and this is my former day job kind of coming back to haunt me. I've been feeling like that way about Google. For a long time, because people are like, oh, you should do Google Docs. Oh, do Google Spreadsheet. Do Google. I mean, pretty much it's all Google. I'm sitting there going, you know, I don't feel that comfortable.
Giving everything to them.
Putting everything to Google. I mean, because at one point, Google could just clamp down and say, we're not doing this anymore.
We actually just saw an example of that with Mevio.
Or we're we're giving your information away to people, or the government wants your information and we're just going to give it to them.
Well, I mean, but then Pip just mentioned that with Mevio. Go ahead and bring that. Yeah, that was brutal.
Mevio with podcasters was the place to be, and
when they were called Pod Show, and they were run by Adam Curry, and then Adam Curry out of the blue just suddenly said, "Yeah, we're not calling ourselves Pod Show anymore. We're calling ourselves Mevio."
Yeah,
and we're like.
And then, like, was it 3 weeks ago? They said, we're not doing podcasting anymore. You're going to have to find somewhere else to go.
I mean, literally, they dropped people that had been with them for years. And then they said, yeah, we're done. Yeah. And I mean.
So I guess my advice is, I always like to err on the side of caution, you know, hope for the best, plan for the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say put your foot in a lot of different areas. Try and, you know, stay with a large New York publisher if you can. Maybe for some other things, you want to go with a smaller publisher. I mean, Pip, you're doing that really well right now. You're with Berkeley, which is part of Penguin. You're with Pyre, which is a smaller organization. You're with HarperCollins, with Harper Voyager. And you've got podcasting stuff, and you've got ebooks. You guys are spread enough that if one of those things hits you, it's not going to kill you. It's going to hurt. It's not going to kill you. And I think that would probably be my best advice to authors.
It's just a flesh wound.
Flux and chaos. Yeah. What do? You spread your footprint so you have a little bit of stability.
Don't put all those eggs in the Amazon basket then.
Yeah, yeah. Unless they float down the Amazon and they're out of reach. I mean, so wrapping up, you know, I would agree with Lori is that the authors need to not only look at what Amazon is offering, but also think long term. You know, I mean, is Amazon, because if Amazon were to suddenly say, you know what, we're changing the game, what are your options?
Yeah.
You know, and as far as the whole thing about self-publishing versus legacy publishing, there is still something to be said about legacy publishing in that, ebooks are great. Ebooks look like they're the future, but it's not the future now. The future isn't happening now. We're getting to the future. And there are still just as many people
that. I think
that,
in 5 years it'll all be settled out.
I think that's.
So let's have it back on in five years.
We'll let's come back on this podcast in 5 years
and go. Yeah, we were right.
But I mean, but no, there's still people that go into airports and they make the impulse buys, you know, and there are people that still make the impulse buys with the books. So there is a place for traditional publishing. But I also think that, yes, I think that while people hold up Amanda Hawking and Conneth and all those other folks up on the pedestal, that's great for the short term. That's, you know, they tap.
I mean, even Amanda Hawking is diversifying.
And
I mean,
she's diversifying. But yeah, because she said, you know what? I don't always want to edit. You know,
I don't want to market stuff. I want someone else to do it.
I want someone else to do that. Yeah. So. In, you know, in 5 years, it's going to be, you know, the game will be what the game will be, but I agree with what you're saying, Lori, is that authors they not only have to broaden their stance and broaden their skills as authors and become marketers and become PR people and get a gauge of when too far is too far, but they also have to look at the long term. You know?
And you know what? There's no such thing as a free lunch. Amazon looks tasty now. It might not look so tasty in a couple of years.
In 5 years, it may be looking pretty rank.
Well, and plus, you know, they've already shown you a couple, you know, they've opened the kimono a little bit and let you peek inside. That whole thing about going into a bookstore and then spying on the prices.
And
back to Amazon and buying it online. I mean, come on. If they're capable of doing that, what else are they capable of doing?
The geisha looks good on the outside, but I don't think you want to peer too deeply into the kimono.
Whoa, where has that been? Oy
vey. I like the Bill Clinton philosophy on China, for example, where he said you can just ignore them and say you're not going to deal with them because of human rights abuses and everything else, or you could go in there and work with them and by virtue of being next to them, try and change them. And I really feel that's the way to do it, kind of infiltrate and change while you're working with them. I think that's a lot more successful way than boycotting.
Sounds good. All right, I think we've covered a lot of good stuff. Thank you for spending time with us, Laurie.
Yeah, thanks for adjusting your schedule on a short notice and doing this. So
thank you for giving me a little corner of your shared desk.
Absolutely. So do you have anything real quick to pimp?
No.
You've got a blog, right?
Yeah, you got a blog, right?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. You can actually. I, you know, you talk about, real quickly here, you talk about authors and what are they going to do? What are agents going to do?
Yeah.
We're in the middle of all this, and I haven't even talked about that. That's probably a whole other show. last year, I started a university, San Francisco Writers University, because I really feel that regardless of whether you self-publish or publish traditionally, you've got to be improving your craft constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And people can find that where?
Marketing, things like that. So that's at sfwritersu.com. Free to join, and lots of free classes and $10 classes and things like that. And then this year, I started up two e-publishing companies. One is called Joyride Books, and it's for vintage out-of-print romance that has been languishing in the vault for decades, bringing that into the light and helping authors get their rights back, get the rights reverted to them, and then putting it out there with, you know, a kind of a hybrid model, traditional and new publishing, indie publishing, and then one for middle grade and young adult books as well called Ambush Books.
Oh.
So I started those companies with two of my clients who are very prolific and award-winning, Doug Reese for the children's book and Linda Wisdom for Joyride. So that's what I'm doing as an agent to also spread myself. You know, I have the largest footprint out there.
Yeah. Do you have websites for those imprints?
Joyridebooks.com and ambushbooks.com.
Woohoo!
And where can people find you online?
You can find me all over the place. At Twitter, I'm at Agent Savant. That's really the place to find me. I have a blog, agentsavant.com. And, of course, the Larson Pomada Literary Agency website, which is larsonpomada.com, which has a ton of really great information for authors.
That sounds good.
Fantastic. Lori, thank you very much for joining us. We're just going to go ahead and here and sign off because the Share Desk is protected by the Creative Commons 3.0 Share Alike No Derivatives
Attribution.
What have you? You know, the drill. The thing that I did last week that I can't remember now because it's late. F you. And until next time, enjoy the ride.
And we'll catch you later.